Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And once again, we have my dear mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn, on the line. How are you today?
Good morning, everyone, on this beautiful day. Beautiful day out. My gosh. Oh, God. Sunshine.
Yes, it's a gorgeous day. I'm in the Boston area, and we're going to be almost 70 degrees today, which is unheard of for November.
Wow. And
wow.
I'm in Texas, in Austin, Texas, and I think it's going to be close to 80, but that's not unheard of for here.
Right.
Well, it's 36 here, so there you go.
Yeah.
So, who do we have with us today, Mom?
Oh, gosh. We have a really exciting book today. It's called Love, Theodosia, and it's by Lori Goldstein. And she is a creative writer instructor, manuscript consultant, and the author of 4 novels for young adults. She credits her BA in journalism with giving her the skills and desire to conduct an extensive research that forms the core of her adult historical debut, Love, Theodosia. And there would have to be a lot of research on this. So you're going to enjoy hearing about this book and reading it. You really are.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Lorianne.
Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
So what made you decide to switch from, first of all, journalism to writing for young adults, and then from that to writing historical fiction for adults?
So the first switch from journalism to writing fiction is my second career. When I began my journalism degree in college, and I was editor-in-chief of my college newspaper, and I really wanted to be in that deadline-driven, newspaper-driven world. And then reality came after graduation, and it was very, very hard to get a job in that field. And I did a little bit for a couple of magazines, but I couldn't quite break into the newspaper world the way I wanted. And I wound up doing other kinds of nonfiction writing, copy editing, working for some trade journals, working for some IT journals, which at that time, when after I graduated college, I had moved to the Boston area and was very heavy on kind of tech publishing. And those were the jobs that I kept getting. And as soon as I got one, it seemed people said, oh, you have experience in tech editing. Great. We'd love to hire you. Which I appreciate. You know, you want a job and you want to do well and succeed, but it wasn't the area of journalism I really had been wanting to do. And I did that for quite a number of years. And then I started branching out to do some freelance work to try to integrate more of the things that I was interested in. And it was through that process of kind of doing some more freelancing, working for my own, that the idea of saying, you know what, I'm a huge reader. I love writing. Let me switch gears and see what it's like to write something fictional. And so that was how the first switch from journalism to kind of fiction writing happened. And I learned that I, even though I was a reader, and even though I knew how to write, I had no idea how to write fiction. So it was a whole new world. And I opened up to myself of a education that I had to give myself to figure out how do I write fiction, and then centered on writing young adult fiction as my first novels.
How did you go about teaching yourself to write fiction?
The wrong way, and then I learned the right way.
All right, what was the wrong way?
So the wrong way was just winging it. And I know you speak to a lot of other authors, and I'm very curious what they say to you. But at least for me, the process of just sitting down with kind of just a kernel of an idea and just typing away, and the story would come to you, and the muse would be there, and you'd form this great book. Well, that doesn't happen, or it doesn't happen for me. I am not a wing it person in, you know, my normal life, so I don't know why I thought winging it as writing fiction was going to work. So I wrote a book over the course of 3 years, and it was probably at one point a women's fiction novel that has not been published, and I do not think will ever be published. But at one point, it was topping out at 600 pages, which is just absurd for that type of book. It's not Game of Thrones, you know, it should not be that long. But I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't have an inherent knowledge of story structure, of kind of how you, what plot points are, what plot points are supposed to do, how you manage subplots, all of these things that are very craft-based and I think very learnable and very teachable, which is why I teach creative writing now. I teach all the things that I wish I had known and that I actually did learn after that 3-year process of writing this book, that it was very, very difficult and it didn't have to be. And after I finished writing that book, I had learned some, you know, I had picked up craft books and read them, but it wasn't until I went to a course that was a week-long intensive course of novel planning. And everything the instructor said during that course, just light bulbs were just going off in my head over and over again. I was like, this is what that book was talking about. And this is what that book was talking about. And he, that instructor, it just clicked for me in my brain, made everything come together. And the novel I sat down to write after that first novel that took me 3 years, I was able to write that next novel in 3 months.
Whoa. And it wasn't 600 pages.
It was not 600 pages. And it's actually the novel that got me my agent and got me my first book deal, which became the young adult novel Becoming Gin.
So it's Becoming Gin and Circle of Gin, Screen Queens and Sources Say. So
yes.
those are your young adult novels. And now the switch from there to adult historical fiction, because you were, you're having quite a lot of success with those books.
So it wasn't planned. And I and maybe some of the best things aren't planned. I would never have called myself a like passion project writer, somebody who, you know, gets this thing and they just have to write it. You know, I'm a writer who I love coming up with story ideas. But if I presented 3 story ideas to my agent, she said, oh, that's the one that I think would work well in the current marketplace, I'd say, OK, great. I'll write that one and I'll find what I love through the process of writing it. Love Theodosia really is not that, and is my first passion project that I've had. And the spark of it came to me while I was watching on Broadway the Hamilton musical pre-pandemic, obviously. And this idea during that show, there's a song, for those who are not familiar with the show of Hamilton, it's about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, who were rivals and were friends too and became enemies. And there is a more subdued song in the show called Dear Theodosia. And it's kind of a love letter of sorts of both of these fathers to their newborn children. But one of these newborn children was a daughter, the other was a son. And as they're singing in this song about the fathers they want to be and the world they want to pass on to these children, the idea of a Romeo and Juliet story just popped into my head. You have these two rival, you know, families, and they each had a child, a girl and a boy born less than a year or about a year apart. And it's the idea of what would happen if those two developed, had a romance and it put their, you know, families at odds. So it was just kind of sitting in that audience that the idea just came to me. And I went home from that trip to New York watching that musical. And I started Googling who was Theodosia Burr, who was Philip Hamilton. And one of the things I found pretty early on in my first kind of rabbit hole session was that the two, as young children, attended the same French school for a while. And as soon as I found that fact, I kind of felt like, okay, now this story can grow legs. Now I have something I can hang my hat on, because they did interact and they were in the same circles. And it just went from there. And that's how the adult historical, came to be for me.
Now, Laurie, I had forgotten that we had talked to you earlier, about a year ago, for
yes,
Sources
I think we,
Say.
Yes,
yeah,
I think we did.
Yeah. And because this book was so different, I didn't immediately make that connection. Is it hard for a writer who has developed an audience for a certain type of book to break into another field and convince a publisher to go along with it?
Well, so my publisher who published Screen Queens and Sources Say, that was an imprint of Penguin called Razorbill, and they are only a young adult and a little bit of a middle grade imprint. So they couldn't acquire this even if they had wanted to. It's not what they do. So it was, I had to go out and try to find a new publisher. And that's partly why I added, as this book has my middle name on it, Laurie Ann, as a little bit to distinguish from those young adult books and to kind of put it in its own category. But it actually was The fact that I had previous young adult novels was great because people, editors knew I had been through the process of what it's like to work with a publisher, but they're very, very different genres. So in the actual, in the publishing landscape, it was not a hindrance nor a help. It was kind of just starting all over because it's an entirely new genre. So your history doesn't quite affect it because it's an entirely new readership.
Right. And of course, for you, you know, having built an audience, you probably have Twitter followers and Facebook and so forth. You kind of have to start over with that too, don't you?
To some degree. And I think what's a little bit helpful as this, even as a transition book from the young adult to the adult world, is it is, as many historical books are, the characters are younger. You know, they're 17, 18, 19 years old. And there's some crossover appeal, I think, for the higher end of the young adult readership. And certainly readers who, you know, my first young adult book was 2015. So by now, they're certainly of an age where they could be reading adult books. So it's kind of a nice transition in, and especially because it's got that tie to those who do like Hamilton, would find this appealing. And so I think it crosses the age and the genre a little bit.
That's a good point.
How did you start to find out all these things about these people? How did you start with your research? Because it was just amazing, you know, the things that you put in here. And I read in the back of the book that a lot of it was true. Some of it wasn't, but some of it was. And so how do you get that? How do you discern what you're going to put in? That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah. So I started my research, as I said, kind of doing this Googling of, you know, who are these people? And you read the things that are, you know, are online, whether it's, you know, articles or Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, and you try to get that just cursory basis of, you know, the timeline of what happened during, you know, this set in the year of 1800 in New York City, but who my main characters were. And then I kind of took that information and tried to say, how can I go deeper to really learn who these people are? And especially Theodosia Burr as our narrating character and her father, because the book, while it's got this imagined romance with Philip Hamilton, it is very much about her relationship with her father. So understanding who they were as real people and how it would translate them to fictional versions of themselves was the biggest thing I think I really had to get my hands around before I could really even think to write the story. And I was just fortunate to come across a book from 1918 in my local library in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that I could not find this book anywhere else. I tried to buy it because I wanted to own it, and it's out of print, and there was no way I could find it. But it's some of the only surviving letters between Aaron Burr and his daughter. And I say some of the only surviving.
Gosh.
Yeah, it's fascinating. She, Theodosia, this is not covered in the time frame of my book, but she is actually lost at sea later in life. She disappears on this ship, and there are many theories about what could have happened, but she was traveling from South Carolina to New York, and the boat sinks and disappears. And with her on that ship were letters. She was kind of she was holding on to many of Aaron Burr's personal papers and his letters to her and her to him. He had gone abroad, and so she was kind of, you know, keeping these things safe with her in South Carolina, and she was bringing them back to him. And so a lot of the historical papers that belonged to Aaron Burr were lost.
Wow.
So the fact that we have these as a reference is rare and is terrific. And there were more letters from him to her, but there were enough from her so I could get a sense of her personality, how the two of them interacted. They were very sarcastic with each other in a way that I just didn't expect. You don't expect that of people of that time frame.
Certainly not a father and daughter.
Absolutely not. And they were very like frank. And he talked about his wife had passed away when Theodosia was 11. And so a lot of his letters were about his romantic exploits
that he was writing to his daughter about. That's just.
Yes,
very surprising.
Yes. Surprising, unexpected. But it gave such a flavor for the relationship that they must have had. And that was really a vital part of my research in terms of actual things. There were some quotes from the letters that I used as dialogue for them, but also getting just that sense of who they were. And then other things in terms of research, I went to the New York Public Library. They have a great stash of historical photographs, although at this time period it was drawings because it was 1800. There weren't photographs yet, of what it was, what the city looked like in that day. So they gave me this big folder and I sat at this table and I was able to flip and see, you know, what the streets look like and, you know, what houses looked like, what the people were wearing. And they said it was fine to take photographs. So I took photographs, you know, so I could take that home and have them with me when I was writing. And that was a fun and kind of fascinating aspect of the research that I did.
I was wondering, how did politics differ then from now? I mean, because it's crazy now. It seems like it was crazy then too, right?
It was crazy then too. You know, I think people who think that what's going on today in politics is unique, as I researched this book, they should do a little research into the year of 1800, because this was one of the nastiest and most bitter elections in the country's history. And it really set the precedent for the two-party system we have today. And it was also the first test of a peaceful transfer of power in what was a very new country at that time. The lead up to the election was full of candidates insulting each other and saying inflammatory and outlandish things. And at the time, which I don't think either I realized and a lot of people probably understand or realize, was the parties were behind the newspapers. So they actually paid for the newspapers. They owned the newspapers. And they basically printed whatever was going to be a pro for their candidate and anti the other candidate, regardless of fact. So the kind of divisiveness of the country during this election, there were rumors of civil war. There were rumors of assassination attempts when we got to kind of this pivotal part of the election of there was a tie and who was going to actually come out ahead. There was so much going on that almost makes it look a little tame of what was going on today in politics. So it also makes the book very relevant to our current time.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Laurie Ann Goldstein, author of Love, Theodosia. And let's delve a little bit more into this political situation. What were who were the candidates, and who were the sides, basically?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so the election of 1800, there was the Federalist Party, and the candidate for them was actually the current president at the time, John Adams. And he was up against the Democratic Republicans, generally then called the Republicans after that, Thomas Jefferson. And it was ultimately a real battle between the North and the South, ideological differences regarding the United States' involvement in the French Revolution, issues with the people wanting to centralize government or not, having a standing military or not. These were a couple of the really big issues of that time. And it became a very kind of nasty fight, as I was discussing, and a lot of kind of what we now call mudslinging. Jefferson was thought of as kind of lazy and a coward, and Adams was said to be quite argumentative with a quick temper. And these were the two people who were up for president. But what's very interesting is this is something that changed how elections were run in this country. At the time, the Electoral College was in existence, but the voting procedure for the Electoral College was a bit murky, and the electors voted for their basically top two candidates, regardless of party, of who they wanted to be president. So every elector would put in two votes. So say you could put in Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. And the idea was that Aaron Burr was the second, was the running mate. However, these ballots did not delineate that. It did not list one as president and one as vice president, because at the time, whoever came in second became vice president, which could be someone from another party. So these electors, all they had to do was write down their top two candidates as for president. And in doing that, in this election of 1800, it became a tie between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. So instead of one being the forerunner, they were equals. And there's some, you know, thoughts in history that I reflect in the book that Aaron Burr had orchestrated this, that he wanted to be president, and he kind of did some underhanded backdoor deals to ensure that he would be try to win against Jefferson, but at the very least enter into this situation where it was a tie.
But they were in the same party.
They were in the same party. Because all you did was there were four names on a sheet, and you just checked off the two that you wanted to be, you thought were qualified to be president. And so that could result in a tie because you're writing down two names.
Wow. Boy, talk about complicated.
absolutely. The detail about this election, there are many great scholarly articles about it that I read, but it took me a while to wrap my head around it because it's things that we just don't have today. It was a very, very complicated process of how this happened. And then once we knew that there was a tie, it has to go down to Congress to vote to see out of these two candidates. So the other two are gone, Adams and the other candidate, Charles Pinckney, were out of the picture. It's now just down to Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, and Congress has to vote between those two and select one as the president, and the second will be vice president. But they were so divided, it took 36 votes for them to eventually get to the point where Jefferson came out ahead and became president and Aaron Burr became vice president.
So it was tied for 35 votes?
Yep. Yes.
And how is that even possible?
Yeah, and you think, like, maybe we should have an odd number voting so we can't get a tie.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, there was a lot of political scheming going on both sides of these candidates and the parties and the people who were proponents of each of them to try to ensure that their candidate would win. And those were things from, like, okay, if I vote for Jefferson, my state wants this. And if I vote for Burr, my state wants that. And there was a lot of negotiating going on in the background to try to ensure the candidate that the electors wanted or this particular state wanted would win.
But they were from the same party.
Yes.
Yes. Did this cause a huge schism in the party?
So what's interesting is they were in the same party, but Burr had formerly been a Federalist and changed parties, as the Hamilton musical tells us, to become a Democratic Republican. So the Federalists were very much behind him because they thought his leanings probably were still their leanings. So even though technically Burr and Jefferson were in the same party, there was at least outwardly a lot of thought that Burr would be sympathetic to the Federalist side. So the Federalists were kind of rallying behind him, and the Democratic Republicans were rallying behind Jefferson.
And where did Alexander Hamilton come down?
So Alexander Hamilton could not get out of his own way, and he was very much, he did not like Aaron Burr. And even though Aaron Burr might have been sympathetic to the Federalists, which was Hamilton's party, he was a proponent of the Federalist Party, even though Burr might have been more sympathetic to his own party, his dislike for Burr won out, and he was pushing for Thomas Jefferson to win.
And, of course, that is in Hamilton in the musical, too, where and I think what he says is that at least you know where Jefferson stands, and Burr doesn't
yes.
stand for anything. I don't remember the lyrics of the song, but it was something to that effect.
I will not sing it for you, but that is very close to the lyric. Yes. And that is somewhat true to history, that there were people who really thought Burr was not vocal about what he wanted and his thoughts. And, it's you read different biographies and they all have a different take on it. Some say that's not true. And Burr did have principles and was very behind what he of his beliefs. Some say he did change his beliefs, and then that is, it's even a debate we have today. Is it okay for a politician to change his beliefs when you learn more and the world changes, or are you looked at as, being wishy-washy or not non-committal? Kind of some of these same issues were plaguing Burr in his life, and also as how biographers look at him afterwards.
Now, so did Burr actually become vice president then?
He did.
And see, we don't even remember that about him.
Yes.
No,
yes.
I know. Yeah.
What we remember about him is that he shot Alexander Hamilton in a duel, and that's pretty much it. But there's a whole lot more between this point and then that happens with Burr.
Yes, because he becomes vice president in 1800. And I'm sorry, I forget exactly what year the Hamilton duel occurred. But he was active in politics beyond being vice president. He had wanted to be governor for a time, and he had been senator before he was vice president. But he was very much active in American politics up until the duel, and then he basically had to flee the country after that.
Now, he was accused of treason at some point?
Yes, he was. It was a very complicated. It wasn't for killing Alexander Hamilton, which I think some people believe that's why he was on trial for treason. There were rumors and some evidence that he wanted to create another country by taking over lands to the west and lands that included Mexico. And in some of the dealings for doing that is where this trial for treason came from. And there were some evidence to suggest that perhaps Theodosia was knowledgeable about that and part of his plans for, I don't want to say them founding their own country, but, you know, in a very, very simplified way, that was kind of what was going on.
And I just looked up, Alexander Hamilton died in 1804. So
right after this, right?
Was Burr still vice president at that time when the duel happened?
He must have been. I believe he must have been. Yes. Yes, which is just amazing to think about.
It is. It's like, I mean, that just makes it so much more unbelievable that he would do that.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it's some of the things I read about duels of the time to try to get us, you know, a flavor and a sense of them. You know, this idea of honor being so pivotal and the guiding force for men of that time, that a duel was something that they would do. And was it a last resort? I hope so. But that their honor was so important to them that they felt like they had to enter into these duels in order to protect it. I don't think that's something many of us really relate to today.
Even though it was illegal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
No, today you can just ruin somebody's reputation, but you don't have to kill them. I mean,
right.
You know, it's still done though, but it's just a different way. this thing about dueling, because of course. Well, I'm going to be a spoiler. I'm not going to be a spoiler and tell what happens. But anyway, this book is very interesting because, you know, you're on tenterhooks the whole way too, wondering what's going to happen between this love affair. And then, you know, it's really interesting.
Well, thank you. I mean, some people who do know the Hamilton musical, we won't give any spoilers. But if you do know the Hamilton musical, you kind of go in maybe with a sense of some direction that the story might go. And, you know, I love being able to still try, for those people who might know the history and the true history, although I guess you don't know if I stay true to that true history or not, because it is historical fiction. But it was part of my challenge of how can I really invest people in this story who might even know part of the historical outcome, and how do I kind of create that tension, even for those people who are somewhat knowledgeable about the course of history.
Well, that was one of the things I wondered about when I was reading this, is that it's so grounded in historical fact, and yet one of the central themes of the book, which is this romance between Theodosia Burr and Philip Hamilton, is, as far as you know, entirely fictional. Why did you, you know, I'm just wondering, why do that rather than stick more towards what you could prove had happened, or that what you knew, you know, what was known about her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a great question. And as a new writer of historical fiction, it's something that I actually did a lot of research about into just the genre of historical fiction before I took this leap to say that I could enter, have this imagined romance be a thread in the novel and make sure that that kind of worked with what readers would expect and what editors would be expecting. And in the process of that research, I learned that there is just so much that historical fiction writers do of inventing romances that could have been, or storylines that could have been, within the context of kind of what else they're writing about and what else is going on. So it felt very much in line of what the genre would accept or allow. So I felt comfortable doing that. I also, as I said, felt comfortable with the imagined romance because they did interact, and this is a could have been, even if it was not a have been, although we don't know, who knows, it could have been a secret romance that was never written about. But I really wanted to ensure, if I was going to make this romance happen, that the rest of the things that happened in the novel were true to history. So I didn't want to change timelines. lines. I didn't want to change, you know, almost everybody in the book is someone Theodosia knew and was part of her life. Almost all the named characters, I think there's just one that's an invention just for fictional purposes. But otherwise, her friends, the people she interacted with, were all people that she interacted with and all part of the Burr Hamilton universe. So all the people, the timeline, the events, even down to someone's traveling here or someone's traveling there, is all true to history. So I really wanted to hold myself to the truth of all of those events and make sure that the history and the politics and all of that was absolutely accurate, that and then that would allow for this imagined romance to be woven into that. And that was something I decided that I really felt was important to do. But I kind of felt like the romance for this was, obviously it was my inspiration to say this Romeo and Juliet tale, but I really kind of felt like exploring who Theodosia was, both in comparison and contrast to Philip Hamilton, made for just a fascinating, for me, and I hope for readers, because they were children born of these two very famous men who probably had a lot of similarities in their life for expectations and notoriety. Yet one was a boy and one was a girl. And that meant that the course their lives could take would by necessity, because of the times that they lived in, be very different. The opportunities that would be open to Philip would not be open to Theodosia. And the contrast between the two of them, having, you know, Theodosia was very ambitious in real life and in the novel, but she couldn't do the things Philip could do. And kind of playing with the fact that maybe Philip had all these opportunities but was not quite as ambitious allowed me to really to dig into Theodosia as a character and to have her have an interesting growth arc in her story. And so without that imagined romance, it would have been harder to achieve kind of what I was hoping to achieve with these two characters.
You know, they both died so young. Uh-huh. With, you know, as we know, Philip Hamilton, anyone who's seen the play knows that he also died from being shot in a duel. He was only 19, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Theodosia was lost at sea at 29. And yet they both seemed so accomplished and had done so much by those very young ages. Did people become sort of get thrust into adult roles earlier in that time period than today?
You know, definitely. And, you know, I think it's interesting because there's a quote from Theodosia that she writes that's in the book and is true historical quote that she writes to a man who is courting her and wants to marry her named Joseph Alston. And she writes him a letter to try to stave off marriage, quoting Aristotle, who says a man should not marry until he is 36. Should not marry until he's 36 years old. But women were marrying much younger. and, you know, their lives began at a much younger age than today. And I think especially for women of the time, they were doing many more what we would call adult things from the time that they were in their early teens. And so the time frame to do more was there for them, because they weren't necessarily, especially girls, were not necessarily going to school, you know, until they would have been, you know, 16, 17 years old.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Laurie Ann Goldstein, author of Love, Theodosia. Laurie, would you read from the book for us?
Sure, I'd love to. Okay, so the scene I'm going to read is actually early on in the novel. It is around page 17, and it is the first interaction that Theodosia and Philip have. They were childhood, they knew each other as children. He has just appeared at a salon that Theodosia was attending, and then he left the salon, and shortly thereafter, Theodosia leaves to walk home. And so that's the preface for what this scene is. Theodosia rounded the corner and nearly stopped short. Philip was leaning against a lamppost whose oil had yet to be lit for the evening. Surprise wiped away the roguish grin on his face. I admit I was expecting Lottie, but still, it's a pleasure to see you again, Miss Theodosia. Yes, likewise. Theodosia's response was polite but terse. Their fathers had a long history of opposing views that had reached greater and more intense depths in the preceding year. Her father, a former Federalist, had embraced the Republican Party and subsequently won the Senate seat once belonging to Philip's grandfather. Since then, her father and Phillips, a leader of the Federalist Party, had been working against one another, vying for party control of the state legislature. Of vital importance, as it was this legislature and those having the majority in it that would select the state's delegates to the Electoral College. Most believed it was New York State that would determine the fate of the upcoming presidential election of 1800, which they could have been discussing in the salon instead of Lottie Jewell's new fondness for oysters, thanks to some boy. Theodosia clutched the cord of her reticule tighter around her wrist, letting the small bag float against the fabric of her gown as she issued a curt nod to Philip and continued on her way. Philip fell into staggered step beside her. "Tell me, how were you able to pull yourself away from the salon at the exact moment it was getting good? Unless you have mastered the art of being in two places simultaneously, this is a conclusion you make how?" Theodosia asked without a pause in her stride. "Because I'm confident those dear ladies finally have a topic worth discussing." "Is that your life and aim then? Is that your aim in life then, to be gossip fodder?" "I've no aim, Miss Theodosia. That much is clear." Her quip had more of an edge than she'd intended, and silence took over. She expected at each corner he would make his goodbyes, and yet he remained. As the two continued west, the city streets gave way to more rural surroundings with increasingly wider and longer spans of green grass and rolling hills. The stench that came from too many horses and people in too small a space gave way to the delicate scent of apple blossoms and the earthiness of hardy oak trees. She'd traveled to and from the city on her own before, though her father disliked it. Yet in this, she wondered what he would have more of an aversion to, her unescorted walk or her escort being Philip. "Would you care to offer a critique?" Philip finally said. "You should wear a coat and discover a comb." Philip laughed, a full round sound that sprang forth with such genuine pleasure that Theodosia felt her own cheeks lift. "Sound advice," he said, "but in this instance, I was speaking of my poem." "Your poem? You mean your recitation?" "No, I mean the poem, my poem." "You're saying you came up with that on the spot?" Philip cocked his head. "Well, if I'm to be entirely truthful, aha, I knew it wasn't yours. And here we've arrived at your aim." "I beg your pardon?" "Being right. I remember that about you. You always have to be right, or think you are." "It's not a matter of opinion, it's a matter of fact." Her lips dropped all vestiges of that smile he'd almost engendered. "The better one is educated, the more they are right. A knowledge of books cannot replace a knowledge of life, not that anyone with their wits about them would want it to. And you know much of the latter and less of the former. Is that so?" Philip shrugged, "if the rumors are to be believed." "And what are those rumors? Don't you know? I don't participate in gossip." "A shame. Happens to be a tremendous amount of fun." Theodosia felt a headache coming on. "Can we return to the poem? Whose is it?" "I said it's mine. The truth part is that I didn't come up with it on the spot. Not all of it, at least. I've been working on it for some time." "You write poetry? Do you not study at Columbia College? I thought you didn't participate in gossip." "The attending of an institution is fact, not gossip, and I would think Columbia College would require a work ethic that would preclude writing poetry. But you don't know, do you?" "Because women cannot attend," Theodosia thought. "If you could attend," Philip continued, "you'd discover college has pursuits both in and outside of the classroom entirely worth pursuing. If your father would allow it, of course." "And what do you know of my father? As much as you know about mine, I suspect. They're both heroes of war. They understand how important it is to know your enemy. They aren't enemies. They just disagree because your father is wrong." "Probably." "Probably." Theodosia halted. "Probably? Do you not defend your own family?" "My father is old enough to defend himself and wipe his own nose and arse. But I do listen to rumors, and it seems the same cannot be said of yours. Philip Hamilton, you insult us both and embarrass yourself. And you, Theodosia Burr, do not deny it. Your father has always been too dependent on you. How disappointing that the same appears to be true in reverse." Anger propelled her forward, but she stayed true to the etiquette Philip lacked and managed a "good day, Mr. Hamilton." "An escort doesn't abandon his duties before seeing them through to completion." "I doubt you have the disposition to plead anything but the emptying of a pint of ale. This is far enough. You're not behaving like a gentleman, thankfully. Gentlemen are so dull. Truly, where's the girl I once knew who on a dare locked a pig in the school outhouse and nearly got Tammy McIntyre's bum bitten off? She grew up, something you might try. Not if it means being a snobbish bore. I should instead be an aimless drunk seeking pleasure in the skirts of young girls whose only thoughts are the ones they're told to have. Is there an actual contest between those choices? You're a disgrace to your father, Mr. Hamilton. Better than being a puppet." Theodosia's arms flew out and she shoved him. "You are a rapscallion scoundrel." That laughter once again, and this time Theodosia's lips pursed and she bit her tongue before she let loose the vent boiling up inside. With thundering footfalls, she marched away from him toward the plank set over the ditch in the marshes of Lispinard's meadows that would take her to the footpath and then home. "If only one could grab a hold, what a tale could be told," Philip shouted after her. Theodosia clenched her fists until her nails dug into her skin. Her feet settled into the familiar gravel, and she thanked every stone and every pebble that would lead her home. Inexplicably, with her next step, she found herself pausing to look back. He stood facing her with an enormous grin on his smug face. his smug, infuriating face. His smug, infuriatingly pleasant face. "This is why I despise salons," she muttered under her breath.
And that was Lorianne Goldstein reading from Love, Theodosia.
Well, you know, what's amazing is that there was no telephones, mm-hmm. and the only way that they could communicate was letters. Mm-hmm. So that's what they did. But, you know, it's just amazing that they accomplished so much without having all this social media stuff.
And
it really is.
And how, yeah, communication was slow. You know, if it
yes.
had to be by letter. I mean, they didn't necessarily even know who won an election right away.
No. Yes. Yes. It was, you know, and as part of that, the election, the results were to be unsealed, I think it's about 8 weeks after the actual election. So the electors voted, and then 8 weeks later, the ballots were open and the winner was announced. One of the things of research I had to do, which I actually was in Charleston and in a museum, and they had something that was perfect for this that I didn't even, you know, I didn't expect to find, but it was a placard from the post office saying how long it took for letters to go from, you know, a certain place to a certain place. And it was something I was trying to desperately find out, of how long it would take for news to travel and for a letter to get from, you know, one location to another. So that was very fortunate that I found that, because it was helpful in
so
my research.
So how long, like, from Washington, D.C. to New York?
And I wish I had written it down. I'd have to go back into my notes and find it. But it wasn't as long as I would have expected, to be honest. I don't even think it was a full week. I think it was less than that.
And did they have trains yet during this time? Or
no.
No trains.
No, no trains yet. Yeah.
So it was just all by carriage.
Yeah, it was all by carriage. Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, if you're...
Pony Express.
Exactly. If it was going west, it went by Pony Express.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things I read about was the further north you got and the more snow, some of these carriages couldn't even go, and they would have sleighs that would take people, you know, through the heavy snow.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Remember that over the river and
gosh.
Through the woods?
Yeah. Oh yeah, times were different then, for sure.
Yeah,
I was curious about something. If Aaron Burr had to leave the country after the duel, was he still in office then? Or was that after he was out of office?
That was after. He left. Let's see if I can remember off the top of my head. But he left. It was later. It was later than the duel, because he actually left. I believe he left after the treason trial, which was later. He was in Europe in the, like, I want to say it was like 1810, 1812, up until that time. So he didn't leave right after the duel. He actually left during his treason trial.
It does seem like Burr is overlooked to a large extent, even though he was so influential in forming the government and the direction of the government at the time. But these scandals that plagued him and Hamilton's, you know, death, and also his enmity before death, really seems to, historically, we look back and Hamilton's been elevated and Burr's kind of been cast aside. Do you think that's partially because so few of his writings survived?
You know, I that's a really good point. You know, it very much might be. And it's also, you know, because when you do the research into these two characters, and regardless of the way the Hamilton musical portrays them, which I think, you know, shows them having flaws, but they were both flawed. And Hamilton did things in history that many people were very angry about, you know, at the time, and Burr the same. But I think the impression was, you know, that Hamilton was more accepted than Burr, and perhaps was on, quote unquote, the right path, and Burr was not on the right path. And that's not true. They were each proponents of policies that some people liked and some didn't. And they were each responsible for major things happening in this country, but I think partly because Hamilton did found the bank and the financial system that the country, you know, helped the country be what it became, was so vital that perhaps he became a bigger figure in history than Burr, you know, even though mm-hmm. Burr's contributions, you know, because of a lot of the politics that surrounded this 1800 our election changed and we became a two-party system, which we were not before that, and election laws changed, but, you know, and very vital to what our country became, but perhaps not as, I don't want to say as sexy, because I don't know if that's exactly right, but just not maybe thought of as prominently as the things that Hamilton had done and were attributed to Hamilton.
Now, the Electoral College, how the electors from each state were selected depended on the state.
Yes.
And in some cases, it was the state legislature who selected the electors, not people voting the way we think of as voting for president. They voted for state legislatures who then voted for electors who then voted for president.
Yes, yes. And as you said, every state had a complicated system. Every state had a different time frame when that was done. So you could essentially know that, you know, say Pennsylvania was going to vote for Jefferson in the election months before you knew what South Carolina was going to do. And that made the process of an election at that time feel like it took 9 months. And I know, I guess now we feel with all the campaigning, it takes a long time. But, you know, it was a long process because it was such a complicated, very specific state by state process. And the campaigning that went on, you know, as you were trying to, this is one of the confusing parts about history that I really had to kind of learn and absorb about this election was, you know, as the passage I just read talks about, whoever controls the New York State legislature will control who New York State elects for president. So the campaigning was, we have to, you know, if you're a Federalist, you want all Federalists on that state legislature, so they'll vote for John Adams. And if you, you know, are a Democrat or Republican, you want to stack your state legislature with those people so they'll ultimately influence the vote for Jefferson for president. So the campaigning for president got down to these very local levels because of the way, the nature of how the elections happened.
Wow. Let's talk about some other sort of controversial issues at the time and how Theodosia and Aaron Burr, too, but primarily Theodosia, you know, how they may have impacted her life. And one, of course, was slavery. Mm-hmm. And Burr was publicly an abolitionist, but was that a little bit hypocritical?
So, you know, many of these men, including Burr and Hamilton, owned slaves and outwardly were abolitionists. And I think it's a fact of our history that, you know, is difficult to address and it's difficult to talk about and it's difficult to understand. And the idea of, you know, these very men who did many things to form this country, but being deeply flawed, and especially when it comes to slavery, it's a difficult topic. And it was something that I knew I had to address in the story and via the lens of Theodosia. And the way I kind of approached it for her was, you know, this kind of like realization of what her father says and what he does might not be exactly the same. And this, you know, how do you love a person as much as she loved her father, but still accept, you know, these flawed parts of them? And how, you know, do you take maybe a parent who's on a pedestal and realize that they don't deserve to be on one? And this kind of very complex kind of growth process that I think, you know, a coming of age that all young adults have to kind of come to, but in a very complicated way for her in terms of some of these specific things, and especially in terms of her family's ownership of slaves and her own complicity in that to as a young child, it was just part of her life and something that she didn't question because she didn't think to question it. And the families around her also owned slaves. And it was not something that was unusual at all for the time. In New York society at that time, you didn't even have to be rich to own slaves. You know, even as long as you weren't at the bottom levels of poverty, well, most people had at least one slave in their home. So it was very much something that she would have been used to and maybe perhaps seem just what was a custom of the time. And as she kind of grows older, learns more about politics, learns more about her father, perhaps having, you know, contradictory beliefs, defending slaves and defending slave owners, which he did in life, she has to then realize, what do I believe? What do I believe independent of myself? What do I feel? And my own complicity in the ownership of slaves and not speaking out about it. And that's part of the Theodosia in the novel's growth process to kind of confront what was going on in her own household and how that reflects what was going on in society as a whole.
Another thing about Burr I found interesting was that he took into his home refugees from France in the Revolution. Mm-hmm. And you know, and made them part of his family, and his daughter and the girl that came were just really very, very close. I thought that was most interesting. I really did.
Yes, you know, and he was as many of these men were at the time, they were big lovers of France and, you know, everything French, and they kept their eye on what was going on in France at the time. And the French Revolution was a big influence for our own politics and kind of how we saw our democracy versus what was going on in the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. Burr was very sympathetic to the French and what was going on. And when he heard that Natalie and her governess needed somewhere to stay, that they had escaped from France because her life was threatened because she was the goddaughter of Marie Antoinette. He took them into his life. And it was actually a great thing for Theodosia, who had recently lost her mother, died a year after they took in Natalie into their home. And she became a really formative relationship in Theodosia's life for the rest of her life, became a sister to her.
Is there much historical documentation of Natalie and what she was like?
There is not all that much. She's mentioned in some of the letters that I had, you know, read in that book that was a compilation of letters between Burr and Theodosia. She's mentioned in there many times between the two of them because she was, you know, a very important part of their life. She actually marries another historical figure, Thomas Sumter, who was an ambassador to France for a time. And I might be wrong, but I believe he became a governor in South Carolina, but another or a senator, a very prominent, you know, politician at the time. So she actually marries him. But there's not a lot about her, you know, despite kind of, you know, having this central role in some of these big figures. There's not too much written about her.
There's just so much in this book. I mean, you get, you know, and the love story between Philip and Theodosia was something else, you know, too. I mean, it was amazing how that developed. So, yeah, it was really interesting.
So that must have been a fun part to write because you got to really be free with your imagination in that part. Was it at all restrictive for you writing, you know, this is the first time you've written really historical fiction like this. So having those historical restrictions, or did it free your imagination in other ways?
In some ways, it's interesting, as I did some research, because I wanted this romance to be secret. The fathers couldn't know. But I also then had to understand, well, how would a relationship happen in this time? Was the, you know, you, I think in my head, I had the idea that comes from, you know, perhaps TV or movies, or that you always have to have an escort, that a young woman could never be out on her own. And that actually was not the case early after the American Revolution, during this time frame when the book is set. Women could go on dates with men unescorted. You didn't have to always be with another family figure. That happened kind of in the Victorian era, a bit later, more towards like the 1840s, 50s, then it became very much, it would have been quite risque for a woman to be, you know, sit in a tavern with a male on her own at that time. But it was actually a little more freer. You could go on walks, you could go on rides, you could have a picnic, although I also learned the term picnic had not been invented yet, so I couldn't use that word. So that kind of gave me a little bit more freedom to put them together in places where I didn't have to come up with an elaborate construct of why they would be able to be, you know, walking together or sitting together or doing something. So that actually was interesting for me to learn as part of the research, and it gave me more freedom to develop their romance in the way I wanted to.
Another kind of issue of the day was feminism. Was Theodosia a feminist?
So as far as I could tell, she would have been called a feminist because she was such a proponent of education for women, and she loved her education. She, you know, even though it made her the object of gossip, she didn't hide it, and she didn't want to hide it. And so I think that would definitely qualify her as, you know, being a feminist or a feminist for the time. And in terms of other women and other things that I learned that I didn't know, Theodosia in the novel writes short stories for a women's magazine. And there were women's magazines at the time. And I allude to an article in the novel about women of New Jersey writing an article proposing that all women should have the right to vote, because at the time, women in New Jersey were the only state where the only women who had the right to vote, white women. The fact that that article was printed kind of seemed a little bit surprising to me when I read that, because I didn't know that women were kind of in any way being vocal about things that we would now classify as kind of being a feminist. And I used that as influence for Theodosia to start to use her voice to want to propel the things that she believed.
So I didn't even realize that women were able to vote in New Jersey. I had thought that one of the Western states was the first, like Montana or Wyoming, because we actually did a book about this recently, about the suffragist movement, and I thought that it was one of those states was the first.
So it was a loophole in the way the election rules were written for New Jersey, and they did get away, they eliminated that. Shortly after this election, so they did not have it for long, but it was a bit of a loophole that they were able to in a couple of election cycles, and then it was taken away.
It really is kind of surprising that Aaron Burr was willing to educate, have his, not just willing, but eager to have his daughter be as well educated as his son, and the fact that he and Theodosia's mother did not have any other children. Do you know why?
So Theodosia's mother was plagued with what was probably stomach cancer, but we did not, you know, was not diagnosed at the time. But she was sick for much of her life, and I think that influenced her ability to bear children. She did have a daughter who did not survive. I think when Theodosia was 3 years old, she did give birth to another child who only lived for a few days before it died. And that was the only other report of her and Aaron Burr having another child in any capacity because she was so sickly. And eventually she would die when Theodosia was 11. But actually Theodosia's mother was married before she married Aaron Burr. She was married to a British officer, which again is mentioned in the Hamilton musical, and she had children with him. So Theodosia actually has had two stepbrothers, much older stepbrothers, who were basically out of the house by the time Theodosia was kind of old enough to remember. So they do not figure prominently in my novel because they were not a part of her daily life, although in real life she did have a strong correspondence with both of them.
And it sounds like they had a good relationship with her father, too.
They had a great relationship with her father. Yeah, he did embrace them as sons. And they kind of, unfortunately, were partly involved in some of his financial troubles. And wow. He borrowed money from some of them and was not able to repay it. They were involved in the relationship with Aaron Burr.
Well, for anyone who has been intrigued by this time period and these people from the Hamilton musical or from other, you know, there has been other books about that time period, biographies of Hamilton or Adams. This is a different take, a look from a feminine perspective, and really a lot of fun. So thank you for sharing with us today, Lori.
Well, thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it. It was great to talk about this with you.
And Caroline, do you have a closing quote?
Well, I do, although this was much more than a love story. This touched me. There is no surprise more magical than the realization of being loved by someone that you love.
Wonderful.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.